I invite you to turn with me to Numbers chapter. No, not Numbers, not quite yet. Before we get into Numbers, we're going to turn to Genesis. Genesis chapter 29. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for your word. And I pray that you would help us to receive what it has for us this morning, and that its truths would transform our hearts one step closer to reflecting completely the image of your Son. In your name, amen. You know, when people think about or read about and reflect on the morality that is taught in the Old Testament, some people will get a little disturbed or bent out of shape when they discover that there is no commandment in the Old Testament against polygamy. And they'll think, well, you know, how advanced could this law be, or how complete could it be that there is no command in the Old Testament against polygamy? The reason I bring that up, and this is really just a side note, the message is not about this today, but in Genesis chapter 29, verses 31 and 32, and not only here, but other places, you discover how many examples there are of the problems that result when people try to have more than one spouse. And so, in my opinion, there doesn't need to be a direct command against polygamy because we have so many examples of how terribly things turn out when you try that lifestyle. And this is just one example here. And there's a reason I'm pointing this out, because it does relate to our study of the book of Numbers. Genesis 29, verses 31 and 32. Whoops, I was in chapter 30. Huh. It says, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, because the Lord has looked upon my affliction, for now my husband will love me. You remember that Jacob worked for Laban for 7 years in the hopes that at the end of that time he was going to marry Rachel, whom he loved. Well, unfortunately for him, during that time, Rachel's older sister Leah never got married off. And so Laban pulls a switch on Jacob, and Jacob ends up having to marry Leah and working another 7 years to marry Rachel. And you can imagine all the potential drama that could be caused in a family and in a marriage by a situation like that. And you see an example of it right here in Genesis 29. Leah was not favored by her husband, and Rachel, her younger sister, was. And so God, in his justice, allows Leah to start bearing children first, and she has a son named Reuben. The reason this is important is if you can turn to Numbers 16 while you're turning there. Reuben, even though he was the oldest of Jacob's sons, he was not Jacob's favorite. His favorite was Joseph. And it was really obvious that Joseph was his favorite. You remember the story of the coat that he gave Joseph. And so you can imagine that Reuben, even though he's the oldest, he's not regarded as highly as an oldest child typically would be, and in a family. And so you can imagine the kinds of things that he felt, the potential for bitterness and anger, the potential for a grudge for his whole life. And when somebody goes that long and nurses a grudge and it causes strife in a family, that strife rubs off on children and children after them and children after them. And you can see where this is going. You have the potential there for a lot of bad feelings and behaviors to be rubbed off on one generation after another. So when we get to Numbers chapter 16, understanding that little bit of background causes this chapter to make a little bit more sense, at least verse 1. Numbers 16, verse 1 says, "Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men." If you would study the first chapters of Numbers and you would look at how the camp of Israel was laid out, you will find that the tribe of Reuben was not camped very far at all from one part of the tribe of Levi, known as the Kohathites. And Korah was a son of Kohath. Okay? Here's what verse 2 says. This is why this is all important. "And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men." Verse 3, "They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, 'You have gone too far, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?'" So, the tribe of Reuben, or some people in the tribe of Reuben, have a problem with the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron were from the tribe of Levi. Levi was not Jacob's oldest son, was he? Reuben was the oldest son. Therefore, in Reuben's thinking, shouldn't that tribe be the one to be the main leadership body over the people of Israel because Reuben was Jacob's oldest? So they've got a problem. And it's not just guys from Reuben's tribe that have a problem. We've got some people from the tribe of Levi. It says Korah in verse 1, "Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi." So these guys, so Korah would be a cousin to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So we've got a leadership, an issue of jealousy in leadership stemming from family drama. Okay. And so they stage a coup, essentially. And it's a well-planned one. Look at the guys they pick. They pull together 250 chiefs of the congregation, well-known men, influential men. Okay. They're assembling their team, getting guys together that are on their side. And then they come to Moses. And they make this interesting argument. Now keep in mind that in Numbers chapter 14, the people of Israel rebelled against the plan of God and they refused to enter the promised land. Huge spiritual disaster because they have no faith. They do not believe that God can give them victory over the Canaanites, and so they can't enter the land. And after that rebellion, these guys have the nerve to stand up and say, look what they say in verse 3, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Baloney. In Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, see, what they're doing is they're twisting God's words. Exodus 19, 5 and 6. Now, these are God's words. He says, now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They were God's chosen people. They were the people to whom God chose to reveal himself. But that did not automatically make them holy. They were set apart for God's special purpose. God is going to reveal himself to them and reveal himself to the world through them. But that does not mean that they themselves are holy in the sense of following his law. In Numbers 14, they completely blew it. They didn't trust in God's most basic promise, let alone follow his law. But what Korah and his gang here are doing is taking God's own words and twisting them in an effort to try to undermine Moses' leadership. They're saying, well, we're all holy. Everybody in this congregation is holy. So what makes you, Moses, holier than us? What makes you, Aaron, holier than us? And they're making this argument in order to remove Moses and Aaron from leadership and usurp their leadership positions. So it's like the Great Rebellion stage two is what's happening here. Continuing on, we're only going to go through verse 11 this morning in chapter 16. So picking up with verse 4, when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. You know, if you want to recognize Moses in heaven, he's going to be the guy with the flat nose. So he's falling on his face. Verse 5, and he said to Korah and all his company, and this company again includes these Reubenites, okay? Here's what Moses says. In the morning, the Lord will show who is his and who is holy and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses, he will bring near to him. Moses is declaring that God is going to clarify for them who his chosen leaders are. Okay. And so here's the showdown that's going to happen. Verse 6. Here's what Moses says. Do this. Take censers, Korah and all his company. Now remember, a censer is like a pan with a long handle. They put incense in it, light it on fire, use it to burn incense. Okay. And so these censers have a very holy use. Remember back in Exodus, Leviticus, God's, it was Exodus, God gives a special recipe for the oil of incense. It was a special mixture of herbs and spices. And remember also that incense symbolizes prayer. Okay? So the whole idea of burning incense in the tabernacle before God symbolizes communion and fellowship with God through prayer, drawing close to God. And remember that it was the tribe of Levi that was chosen for this priestly service. Okay. But remember also that there were two guys back in Leviticus chapter 10 that misused their privileges and they got burned for it, literally. It was Nadab and Abihu. Okay. They took advantage of their position. They tried to basically treat these ceremonies that God had ordained like some sort of magic show, and they wanted to create this fire themselves. You know, really the prevailing attitude among the Israelites, and it doesn't come out and say this, but you can read it between the lines. I think it's become quite obvious after studying these stories. They're treating Moses and Aaron as if they are some kind of magicians. And that the power of a real God is not behind all these things that are happening. You see that come through. We saw that come through in Numbers chapter 12 in the way that Aaron spoke to Moses. He spoke to Moses as if Moses was the one who gave Miriam leprosy and could take it away. No, it was God that did that. So it's like they're just not getting it. That very basic truth that God is all-powerful and he is the one who is acting on their behalf, that's the most basic truth they need to understand here. And if they don't understand that, then they certainly can't understand God's love for them, because God in his power is showing them love. So they can't, if they don't see God's power, then they can't see God's love, they can't see God's promise, they can't see anything else. So that makes them completely blind, spiritually blind. That's where blindness starts. But here's the showdown. Here's what they do with the censers. Verse 7. Moses says, put fire in them and put incense on them before the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the holy one. You have gone too far, sons of Levi. Moses continues on in verse 8. He says, and Moses said to Korah. Now he's... At this point, Moses, in his conversation, in his reply, first of all, was speaking to all of them, Korah and his group, including the Reubenites who had joined forces with them in this coup. But now Moses is going to address them individually. Okay, he's going to address Korah, and then he's going to address the Reubenites. And next week, we will look at what he says to the Reubenites. Right now, we're just going to focus on what Moses says to Korah. Verse 8, Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them. Verse 10, and that he has brought you near him and all your brothers and sons of Levi with you. And would you seek the priesthood also? Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and all your company have gathered together. What is Aaron that you grumble against him? Now, I imagine Aaron standing there overhearing Moses saying this and say, hey, bro, come on. What is Aaron that you grumble against him? Aaron standing there, what? But really, the issue is that, and Aaron should understand this, is that ultimately these guys are going against God. Because the things that Moses and Aaron have done, they have done for God. They have done with God's power. And they haven't even done it according to their own will. Remember, Moses didn't want this job. This whole job of delivering the Israelites and dragging them through the wilderness. This was, if you go back and read the early chapters of Exodus, this was not a job that Moses willingly signed up for. Okay? God kind of twisted his arm into doing this. The Israelites, on the other hand, are treating Moses as if he is some sort of charlatan and magician who is trying to make a name for himself or accomplish something great. When he's not, he's just doing God's will. And he wasn't even willing to begin with. Now, Moses' argument here, we should pay close attention to that. It starts in verse 9. He says to Korah and his gang, "Is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself?" Remember, the tribe of Levi were the ones chosen to all participate in the service of the tabernacle. They were responsible for the sacrifices, the whole sacrificial system, and everything related to it. Taking care of the tabernacle, watching over everything in it, transporting everything in it. They were responsible for that. Now, when we think about all the stories that we have seen of how God has manifested his glory, he's had this cloud of glory over the tabernacle. He has come by night in a pillar of fire. All of those events, those manifestations of God's glory, should have reinforced for the entire tribe of Levi how serious their job is, how glorious their job is. They were responsible for caring for and transporting all this, these temple furnishings that God was using to manifest his glory to the people. And remember, it was through the worship in the tabernacle that people could draw near to God and experience God. And the Levites had the responsibility for caring for all that stuff, doing all this work, transporting all these things. So they should have a huge amount of reverence for all of these things and feel privileged that they were chosen to carry all those things. We're talking about the altar. We're talking about the ark. If you would go back to Numbers chapter 4, verse 4, starting with verse 4, there's a whole list of these things they are supposed to carry, these tabernacle furnishings, all these dishes, these tools, furniture. They're supposed to cover them in a certain way with certain covers that are set aside only for that purpose. Verse 4 of Numbers 4 says, "This is the service of the sons of Kohath in the tent of meeting, the most holy things." So these guys had this precious job. And they were treating it like it was nothing. They were wanting the jobs of Moses and Aaron. Now, you know, maybe some of the jealousy stemmed from the fact that, you know, Aaron and Moses were both from the tribe of Levi. Aaron was chosen to be the high priest. And remember, there's this ephod that Aaron was to wear, and it was inlaid with 12 gemstones for the 12 tribes of Israel. Imagine the beauty of that ephod. And maybe there was a certain way that when Aaron came out and was wearing this, it got people's attention. Of course it would. This thing was incredibly expensive. There's a huge amount of money that went into all of these tabernacle furnishings and into this priestly clothing. And so maybe Korah and his gang saw the way people reacted to Aaron, and they became jealous. Maybe that's a part of it. We don't know. But they were given a glorious job, Korah and his crew, of carrying all these specially designed articles for worship. And they minimized that. They acted like that's nothing, and they wanted the jobs of Moses and Aaron. And so that's why Moses says, "Is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them?" Verse 10, "And that he has brought you near him, and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you. And would you seek the priesthood also?" They are wanting Aaron's job because they're minimizing their own calling. And since it was God that gave them that calling, it wasn't Moses. Moses didn't just assign these duties. This was God's choice. That's why Moses says in verse 11, "Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and all your company have gathered together." What's Aaron that you grumble against him? What is Aaron that you grumble against him? Aaron is God's servant. He's doing what God told him to do as high priest. He's got to follow these instructions. Aaron didn't invent this. Aaron didn't make himself high priest and is delegating all these menial jobs to the people in his own tribe so he can look down on them. That's not at all what's going on. And that's what Moses is pointing out. So we see how Korah and his crew have taken God's words and twisted them. And then they are minimizing their very holy and glorious calling. In John 1, verses 14 and 16. John chapter 1, verses 14 and 16. The Apostle John says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." So all the glory of God that we have seen unfold in these stories in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, Jesus is representing all of that glory, containing all of that glory, and manifesting that glory on earth by living as a man. That's pretty powerful. Okay, so we got to keep that all in mind when we read about the glory of the Son. In verse 16 of John 1, it says, "And from his fullness," what is his fullness? Again, John is talking about the glory of Jesus Christ, which is all of the glory of the Father packed into Jesus as a man, which is, of course, unfathomable. That's his fullness. That's the fullness that we're talking about here, is all of this glory. And verse 16, John says, "And from his fullness, we have all received grace upon grace." As we have gone through looking at these manifestations of God's glory and justice in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, I have pointed out consistently all of the ways that we see God's grace come through. And so Jesus, as the Son of God, is manifesting God's glory and grace for us. Why do I point that out? Turn over to 1 Corinthians 12. 1 Corinthians 12, and it's maybe you're familiar with it. This chapter has a lot to say about spiritual gifts. I'm not going to go into this topic in depth today. I've gone into it before, and I probably will again. But the reason that the glory of God needs to be a big deal for us is because it is contained in Jesus Christ. And the reason that's important is because now it's part of us. Here's how. 1 Corinthians 12, verses 1 through 6. And then I'll read, and then we'll jump ahead a little. 1 Corinthians 12, 1 through 6. Paul says, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brothers, I do not want you to be uninformed." Why does he not want us to be uninformed? He explains it. Verse 2, "You know that when you were pagans, you were led astray to mute idols, however you were led. Therefore, I want you to understand that no one speaking in the Spirit of God ever says Jesus is accursed, and no one can say Jesus is Lord except in the Holy Spirit. Now, there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are varieties of service, but the same Lord. And there are varieties of activities, but it is the same God who empowers them all in everyone." We read in Ephesians 5 this morning. The vision of Jesus is to make his church pure as his bride. Okay. And husbands love their wives based on the way Christ loves the church. And his love for the church is a love that is filled with gifts. He loves to give gifts to his church. And through those gifts, he is allowing his church to demonstrate his glory on earth. Okay? That's why spiritual gifts are such a big deal. Now, I know there are some wrong ideas out there about spiritual gifts, what they are and what they mean. But there are also a lot of right ideas out there about spiritual gifts. Again, I won't go into that in detail, but I'm going to jump to 1 Corinthians 12, verses 12 through 26. And Paul is just, you know, if you're like me, it takes you some time to digest a lot of things that Paul says. Some of the things he says feel kind of complicated. Okay, they're deep. They are deep. Okay. Anthony Flew, before he was a renowned atheist and then he became a Christian, but before he became a Christian, he observed, he read what Paul said, and he said, "This guy is a first-rate philosophical mind." But in 1 Corinthians 12, Paul boils this stuff about spiritual gifts down to a really simple analogy. In my opinion, this is probably the simplest stuff that Paul ever wrote. It's really practical, very straightforward illustration. He says, "For just as the body is one," the body, he's talking about the church, okay? His people, all who believe in Jesus Christ, okay? "For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, 'Because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body,' that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, 'Because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body,' that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing? Where would be the sense of hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged members in the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, 'I have no need of you,' nor again the head to the feet, 'I have no need of you.' On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor. And our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. Really, like I said, practical, simple, straightforward illustration. So think about Numbers chapter 16 in light of this. You've got Korah and his whole family that are minimizing the glorious duty that God has given them to care for and carry and utilize all of the tabernacle furnishings that God is using to reveal himself in his glory to his people. And they are minimizing that job. They just want Aaron's job. Well, not everybody can be Aaron. If every part of your body was a foot, what would you do? Or your lungs. Let's say your lungs just decide, you know what? I'm tired of being so invisible. I've got an important job. I want to be noticed. I want to come out from behind them bones and just show the world how great I am. You know what happens if they do that? Your lungs don't work if they're just going to be exposed, if they're not protected. They're not going to work. But without them, you can't function. They are indispensable. They are needed. God gave an important job to Korah and his family, and they were minimizing that. You know, in the church, as Paul is saying, it's the same thing. We all have different jobs to try to help each other function together as a body. We all have something to contribute. Every Christian has spiritual gifts. Every Christian most likely has more than one spiritual gift. They have a whole grouping of spiritual gifts. Every Christian has an opportunity to serve. Some of those opportunities might be in the form of some elected role in the church. Some may not be, but that doesn't mean they're any less important. The time of year is coming around when the deacons, because according to our constitution, the deacons are the nominating committee. You know, they're gonna sit down here in a while and go through our annual ballot and try to make sure that all the needed roles are filled. And you're gonna, at some point, if you serve in an elected capacity in this church, one of the deacons or me is going to come to you and say, "Hey, are you interested in continuing in your role?" Why? Because your role is important, no matter what it is. Now, that doesn't mean it's a life sentence, okay? Maybe you feel like it is because you don't immediately think that anybody else would want your job. But it says here in 1 Corinthians 12 that there are a variety of gifts, but one Lord. And the Spirit gives them as He wills for the building up of the body. So maybe you've been functioning in one capacity for a while, and maybe God is leading you to do something different, to function in other gifts. That's fine. Be sensitive to that. Pray about that. Or maybe you feel like you should continue serving in whatever capacity you're serving, but you feel unimportant. And you're not. Let the words of 1 Corinthians 12 encourage you today. Every role in a church is important for the function of the church. And if any one of those roles is not filled, something is missing. And we'll all feel the effects of that. God is a good father. He's given us gifts. He's given us abilities that we can use to serve one another. But by doing that, by functioning gifts, by serving, we are carrying his glory into the world. We are representing Jesus to the world. When we come together for worship, this is about God's glory, giving him praise, getting to know him in his glory. Korah and his group minimized that. Don't minimize what you do, because there is glory in it. Even though it doesn't feel very glorious, there is glory in it. And it's important.